Matt, how did you find Nuland's departure? Is it going to affect the foreign policy in Ukraine?
I was surprised by it. I was, looking back, maybe it's not as surprising. A lot of top officials leave administrations in the last year of that administration. As well as Nuland lost in her fight to become the number two at the State Department. She was defeated by Kirk Campbell, and a lot of people look into that and seeing that, okay, here is a determination that Nuland is more Russia-centric, Campbell is more China-centric, and this is showing where U.S. foreign policy is going. This is showing where the mindset of the American establishment and empire are, is we have to, going back to 2012 with Barack Obama famously wanting to pivot to Asia. This is where we need to put our resources. China needs to be our priority. And so Nuland's camp, of which she was one of the heads, and one, certainly one of the most infamous members of that camp, that Russia must be our priority, they lost. And so does her departure, her not getting number two slot at state, as well as whatever went on behind the scenes, does her departure signify that, yes, another Biden term would show more emphasis on China? Well, I mean, we'll see. She's certainly not that old. She's only 62, I think. So she has plenty of longevity left. This will be not the last time we see her. She has been out of government before. She's had a very successful career, both inside government as well as outside government. I mean, she led the Center for New America Security for a number of years, which is the preeminent military affairs, national security think tank for the Democrats in Washington, D.C. So she has plenty of options. We were talking before we came on the air. There's a story in The Intercept today about Mark Milley and how he's been doing since he left the Army and left his post as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff last fall. He's doing quite well. Positioned at J.P. Morgan, positions at Princeton and Georgetown University. He's on the speaker circuit, making an ungodly amount of money and speaking to other elites, right? He's not addressing, students someplace. He's going and he's addressing other elites like himself and those around him. And Newland's already got a position at Columbia, through her friend. I've heard through it was through her friend, Hillary Clinton, who's also at Columbia. So I don't think anyone is worried about Victoria Nuland not landing on her feet. And I also think most of us expect that we'll see her again. And, trying to read the tea leaves here in the sense of what does this mean in terms of overall American foreign policy and where it is, what the priority is going to be. And is that priority shifting back to Asia and to China specifically? We'll see that played out in the next months, and certainly the election in November will have a big impact on that.
Do you think that they forced Nuland to leave her position because she was working on Ukraine for more than a decade? It's so bizarre. It's so unbelievable. It's so shocking.
Certainly, if we had a government that existed upon with any degree of justice to it, then certainly Newland would have been fired and more appropriately put on trial for a number of things, including the coup in Ukraine in 2014. But more especially, just the idea of being held accountable for policies that have not just not weren't just reckless and weren't just dangerous, but all but counterproductive as well. Certainly her policies, and going back now to the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, when she was Dick Cheney's deputy chief of staff, and she was very much involved in the push for the Iraq War, and then transitioning into other positions in the National Security Council and the State Department, where she became more focused on Europe. She pushed policies that were just so wrong-headed and so reckless, and they've brought us to the point now where there are no good options for the United States when it comes to Ukraine within the United States's political window, which is what the options available. You know, the idea that the good option is, of course, for Ukraine is to negotiate, accept the Russian calls for a ceasefire as they've offered all throughout last year. Take Vladimir Putin up on his word, like he said to Tucker Carlson, call his bluff, right? Negotiate and end this terrible war. But that's not politically possible for the Americans at this point in time. And so all the other options that Victoria Nuland's policies have delivered to the U.S. are atrocious, are nightmare options. And that's not even what it means for the Ukrainian people themselves, you know, or the Russian families who've lost sons and daughters to this terrible, stupid war as well. So, you know, I mean, the idea that somehow maybe she got pushed out because of poor performance, if you will, that she's being held accountable for her policies, which, again, in any system that had any merit, had any decency, had any respect to it, that's what you would expect. But this is the American system, and we don't have that. There is no justice. There is no accountability, particularly in foreign policy for the United States. You see men and women who have not just promoted policies that were failures, but that were incredibly spectacularly disastrous as well as counterproductive. So the idea that, yeah, this was she was being pushed out because the policy was wrong. I'd love to think that. But I just everything I know about the American government, about American foreign policy establishment, about the State Department, you know, it was if anything, if there is any type of major disagreement, it was more of Nuland's hurt feelings at not getting number two, this shift towards a China policy that will ultimately and likely, if it's carried out in the same manner the Russian policies were carried out, will prove to be as equally dangerous, reckless, and ultimately counterproductive as the Russia policies were. You know, I think it's got more to do maybe also with some interpersonal drama that's going on that we're not aware of. A lot of times, you know, people, I think, are always shocked when they see that these figures at the top, these people on Mount Olympus, if you will, right, are people just like you and I. And you have the same type of personality disagreements, personality disorders, dramas, tribulations. You know, you see that. You know, these are people who stub their toe just like you and I do. So it's we have to remember that maybe that was it as well. Just that a lot of it may have been nothing more. And I know this is not very exciting and very mundane, but it's nothing more than the workplace drama that you all see in your workplaces. The same dynamics exist. We're all human beings. So certainly that wouldn't be the only reason, but that might be, there might be an element to it. And I would put more to that, the fact that Nuland hates Campbell, you know, that kind of thing, that there's some type of personality thing, than I would of anyone saying, hey, we've got to hold Nuland accountable for this catastrophe in Ukraine.
CNN was talking about Russia outproduces the whole West by three times. And at the same time, we see that the Telegraph talking about the Chinese-Russian war machine could soon overwhelm the West. In your opinion, are we leaving behind these armed control treaties and we are heading toward more armed production, more wars?
I think without dialogue, you know, to plug the name of your program, the results are likely, and we see that in history, right? We see this clash, and I know at this point now, a couple of years after Russia's invasion, everything else has become cliche or trite to compare things to 1914. But I think it is instructive, and I think it's important to do so. You look at those places in history where we've seen that refusal to talk, that refusal to have dialogue, and that insistence, you know, like our friend Larry Wilkerson describes it, a wooden head insistence, excuse me, to continue along the path that you're on, either because of the inertia from your own establishment, that there's no way you're turning, you know, this ship around, this aircraft carrier around, right? You know, that the inertia is just so great within your establishment. And if you look at the establishment, the empire, its inertia, you know, this is, you know, the idea that somehow a $1.5 trillion military industrial complex, an annual $1.5 trillion military industrial complex, which is about what it is going to be able to be moved by any single personalities or a bunch of institutions with the correct moral appropriation on this. You know, it's so we're in this position that if you don't talk and if you continue with this insistence to allow yourself to be swept along. And the problem, of course, is that those who are in the positions where they're able to create dialogue, where they're able to produce negotiations, enter into negotiations, conduct them, these are creatures of the system. So these are people that you are it's the system self-selects who represents it, right? So you and I are not going to be on a position in any, you know, in any part of the American government, any part of the empire, where we talk like this, because it's antithetical to the empire's interests. So, you know, this is something, you know, Noam Chomsky talked about this decades ago. You know, he talked about this with the media, you know, where, you know, the person who's in that interviewer's chair, the person in the reporter's or anchor's chair, they are the only type of person who would ever be there. Someone with different views would never be selected to be put into that spot. So you have this, both the inertia of the system, the inertia of the empire, plus the individuals who lead these institutions that make up the empire are self-selected. You already know what their answer is going to be. So take Victoria Nuland. So now that the person who's in charge of political affairs now at the U.S. State Department, which was a position Nuland had, head of political affairs, you know, John Bass, you know, this guy was Strobe Talbot's chief of staff back in the 90s. Like, this guy has the same mindset. He's come out of the same bubble. He adheres to the same groupthink as all the others do. And you might get minor variations, or sometimes because things have become so desperate, or it's become the reality is so overt, or that there's a possibility that politically a maneuver at that point is conducive or beneficial in terms of a political benefit. But from the, you know, you're talking about fractions, you're talking about shavings off of the whole here, crumbs off the table that you're offered in terms of somehow that there being something that differs from this slavish insistence on, you know, look, the United States is basically, you summarize our empire, the two supporting pillars of it are might makes right and greed is good. Right. So how do you see any future diplomatic foreign policy as opposed to a militarist foreign policy when those are the two very pillars of what the empire is supported upon? That's the foundation of it. That's the ethos of it. So you get to this thing about, yeah, where you're running headlong against headlong into a conflict, into war with Russia and China. And when their capacity for war and their systems, whether it be their societal, their governmental, their economic systems, what have you, are much better prepared and much more flexible, much more robust, and able to take on a war than what we have here in the West. So this notion that, yeah, like, let's keep poking this tiger. Let's keep poking this tiger, or these two tigers, one of which right now, like as you said, just on the ammunition side, is producing three times as much as all of NATO, not the US or NATO, but all of NATO together. And then also as well, the other tiger, well, that's the biggest manufacturing giant in the world. That tiger there, China, manufactures more than the entire West combined. Yeah. Is it the world together? I know it's the West, but like, yeah, probably the whole world together, you know? I mean, so like, who would run face first into that brick wall? But this is what you have. This is the inertia of the empire, coupled with the people who are running it, who are creatures of it, right? And these are, we've talked about this before, they're fabulous, they're fantasists, they're fools, or they're so politically greedy that they, again, that their positions, a guy like Jens Stoltenberg, who for him, his position is everything. Being the Secretary General of NATO and where he will go to next, that's all he's concerned about. That's all he's concerned about. He's not concerned about the welfare of the Baltic nations. He really couldn't give. If you delved into that man's heart, he couldn't care less if for about any of those people that he supposedly puts his heart out there for. For him, for him, it's about the seat he's in. Power is the ends. The power itself is what they want. Power for power's sake. So, yeah, I mean, this is who are being captained by this. These are the people who are leading us. And you put that up against what you framed, these two giants, these two economic giants, one of which is proving itself to be able to be extremely flexible during war. And the other is able to not just have the manufacturing capacity, but the technological capacity that in our arrogance, we're continually surprised by. If you remember 6 months ago, we talked about this because Huawei came out with a phone, I believe. And this was a big deal. If you go back to, I think it was September or so, you go back because Huawei had produced this phone that the Chinese weren't supposed to be able to produce. All our sanctions were supposed to have kept them from being able to produce a phone of this caliber, a phone this advanced. And they did it because, you know, our sanctions are you can, you know, I mean, what the sanctions do, of course, are make people more self-reliant, you know, or in addition, I should say, it also makes them find allies and friends where maybe they wouldn't naturally be allies and friends. So take the Russia-Iran example, you know, which would have plenty of people spitting in their graves, maybe most especially Zbigniew Brzezinski, this idea that somehow Moscow and Tehran are buddies, right? That they're allies. You know, or if not allies, so in a conventional sense of it, certainly they have come to an understanding and an agreement, including trade and fossil fuel and military agreements that go along the line of, hey, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And who's put them in that position? We have. And again, it's the inertia of the empire, and it's those who are self-selected, basically, by the empire who are leading us into that.
It's so tragic. I remember when Vivek Ramaswamy was debating the other Republicans, and he said that our priority is Taiwan. If we cannot save Taiwan because of the chip production, everything that Taiwan has, that China wants to capture Taiwan because they don't have this technology in China. Mm-hmm. And if we couldn't save Taiwan and we, right, in totality, we have to bomb this production, right, these factories. It's unbelievable, the level of ignorance. This guy, if he was still in race, he had a chance in Republican Party.
Right. And people cheered him on for that. Right. This idea that if we can't have it, we're going to burn it to the ground. Right. I mean, that type of psychopathic behavior, you know, people talk about their ex-wives and ex-husbands this way, you know, in that sense of, you know, that having that type of personality disorder. And this is, again, kind of gets back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, how you can't take the individual personalities out of this, right? You can't take, their frustrations, their aspirations, their fears, their desires. You can't take that out of this. And so, you hear that type of rhetoric, but you also see it marked in American history, right? And particularly the example people think, of course, is the phrase that comes out of the Vietnam War, that we had to destroy the village in order to save it, which you could apply to other aspects of American war all through the global war on terror, including our own civil liberties, right? We had to destroy our First and Fourth Amendments in order to save it. We had to enact the Patriot Act and take away our civil liberties in order to save those civil liberties, right? I mean, so there's this doublespeak, this Orwellian type of, and it's become normalized, and it gets repeated through the major American media as if it is, you know, a fact, as if it is just, this is, there's nothing to be, there's no reason to question what's being said, including the people who are speaking, or do they actually know what these words mean? So when you see the American ambassador at the UN saying that we are going to veto this ceasefire resolution in order so that we can have a ceasefire, I mean, that's their logic. That's their rationale. it's almost as if people don't understand what those words actually mean. I mean, you hear American officials all the time saying what's going on in Gaza is not a genocide, it's self-defense. I mean, so you just have these words that are turned upside down and utilized, you know, for narrative and propaganda purposes, and then repeated throughout you know, the American media network. And now, of course, we have this hysteria here in the U.S. Over TikTok and the U.S. House of Representatives. You know, you don't think as an American, you don't think that your members of Congress can embarrass you any further globally than they have. And then they go and do something like this, right? Something something just absolutely so tyrannical, but also so petty at the same time. You know, and so this, but because they can't control language, they can't control the narrative. As the head of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, said, you know, in that leaked audio, we've got a TikTok problem. We can't control this. And I think, you know, the man over my shoulder here, Julian Assange, that's why he has been either under a house arrest effectively at the Ecuadorian embassy or in Belmarsh prison, in Belmarsh now for, it'll be 5 years. It's coming up soon, that anniversary, I believe. I believe it was April of 2019. You know, and what was the crimes? The crimes were transparency. The crimes were honesty. The crimes were exposing and putting into an honest language, right, into a vernacular, if you will, the doublespeak, the exaggerations and the lies that were, you know, offered by the American Empire about what it was doing. And so I think you have this backlash that's occurring, which is a backlash that they're going to do everything they can to destroy, to cancel, if you will. Certainly we saw that with the House of Representatives saying we're going to ban TikTok. But what it gives to me, though, Nima, and I know we've spoke about this before too, is the strength that can come from this technology that we have. So the way you and I are having this discussion now, and the way that so many others are doing this, and this is the main thing about TikTok, right? 150 million Americans are on TikTok, and most of them are not watching teenagers do trendy dances. They're using it for all types of applications, all types of utility. People are they've got their businesses based on TikTok, you know, providing services, you know, providing retail that way. You know, it really is an astounding tool. But it also is a mechanism for people to get information. And so you see that this, what scares them, for the younger cohort in this country, the younger generations, they're getting their news, they're getting their information from TikTok. And so this media that we have, this new technology, this media, the system that we've got here, you know, what this can do in terms of informing and educating and organizing and immobilizing is just, we haven't even touched that potential. And of course, we've got all types of ways they're going to, there's all types of ways they're going to not just be so so thick about it, right? Or so brutal or grotesque about it, like we're just going to ban it. Of course, you're going to see how they're going to use artificial intelligence, right, to mediate it, to control it. You've already seen it that way. You know, you can, some people have done this. They've asked various AI systems, some based in the US, some based in other parts of the world, about aspects of the American Empire, or about, say, something like Gaza and Israel, or Israel and Palestine, excuse me. And you get a controlled answer back from the American systems. You know, I wouldn't surprise me if you were to ask an American AI system about Palestine, it wouldn't use the word Palestine. So just as American politicians will not say Palestine, the American major media, the corporate media, will not say Palestine. They'll say Palestinians. There's a great clip of the White House press secretary trying to say Palestine without saying Palestine. So she begins to say Palestine, and then she starts stuttering, just like I was, and trying to find her words, and, you know, coming up over this process of stuttering, of saying the people, the Palestinian people, or something like that, to avoid saying the word Palestine. I bet if you were to look at American AI systems, you will find some that will not use the word Palestine. It'll say Palestinians, but it will not refer to the geographic entity or the political entity of Palestine. And of course, you know, that's one of the ways that our systems will be controlled in the future, is using AI like that. And, you know, a long-winded answer, of course, but, you know, this is what gives me hope, is this idea that through this technology we have, through programs like yours, we will have a more educated population. We will have a public that is more in tune with maybe their civic responsibilities and their ability to do things and put pressure on things. And hopefully that will, across a whole breadth of issues, cause some type of change and reform, because where we're headed is very, very dangerous.
It's unbelievable how people are repeating themselves in a circle, and they don't think that there should be another option out of this circle. Do you see anybody out of this Republican and Democrat getting on the ballot? Is that possible, in your opinion, in the current situation?
You know, I mean, you look at this duopoly we have here in the U.S. and this idea that somehow Trump is better than Biden, or Biden is better than Trump. And you can find examples where one may meet your needs better than the other. Certainly, you know, Trump comes out the other day and says, I'm against this ban on TikTok. That's a great thing. I mean, but then when you dig into it and you learn about it, he pushed a ban on TikTok himself. And it's only because he's now friends with a Republican billionaire who owns a 15% stake in the parent company of TikTok, you know, and they had a conversation about funding his campaign, and now he's against banning TikTok. And this is why I always say about Donald Trump, is he was the most malleable president we ever had. And that's not a good thing. Malleable does not mean you're open-minded, right? Malleable does not mean that you're looking to learn, you're looking to educate, you're willing to change your opinion. You're not the definition of a smart person is someone who listens to other people and then changes their mind and is willing to change their mind. That's not Donald Trump. But, you know, are there other options out there? And certainly there are. I mean, there's Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. The Libertarians will be running a candidate. The Constitution Party will be running a candidate. You know, and then you have independents as well. You know, as well as too, there are other the Party for Socialism and Liberation, Claudia De La Cruz and Karina Garcia. They'll be on the ballot in many states, but not enough to threaten the duopoly, right? Not enough where they're going to win any portion of any vote that's going to cause a disturbance significant enough to change the results of the election. There's all these arguments about Ralph Nader doing it in 2000, which is bogus, because Supreme Court gave that election to George Bush. You can just ignore everything Nader had to do in it. Plus, there's all other aspects about how many registered Democratic voters in Florida that year voted for Bush over Gore. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to look at it there. You know, the same thing with Stein in 2016. Stein's votes matter, but if you're going to assign all Stein votes to Clinton, then you have to assign all of Gary Johnson and Evan McMullen's votes, which were substantially more, to Donald Trump. I mean, like, so the whole thing is silly. But, you know, there's also, I'm leaving out, there are two independent candidates running, you know, Cornel West, who I'm a great admirer of. Whether he gets on any substantial number of state ballots, we'll see. One of the ways here for people who aren't in the U.S., ballot access, getting onto the ballot, is one of the ways that the duopoly controls their power. So they have a number of different things. One, of course, is a political system where money is 99% of it. So they control the money. They get the money from the corporate backers, and that's basically it. But they also do other things such as gerrymandering, where they select the people in power, select who is going to vote for them, right? Rather than the people selecting who they're going to vote for, right? So by gerrymandering, by picking who your voters are, by designing your districts in a certain way, you can ensure your party keeps power. And then the other, of course, is ballot access, where those in power get to pick who runs against them. So, you know, the parties, you know, in power, and this is as bad in blue states as it is in red states. They control who gets to be on the ballot. In some states, it's pretty open. In other states, it's draconian. It's deliberate. It's deliberately meant to keep people off the ballot. And so I'm getting to Robert F. Kennedy, because I'm sure people are saying, hey, he hasn't even brought up RFK Jr. yet. This is RFK Jr.'s biggest hurdle, is getting on the ballot. And this is something I think he was genuinely surprised about. I don't think he had the awareness of this. I know this because of, I feel that way because of things I've read where he's been asked about ballot access and he has not known about it, particularly here in North Carolina, where he didn't know how many signatures he needed. And when he was told how many he needed, he was shocked, because as an independent candidate, he would need to get 83,000 signatures just here in North Carolina alone to be on the ballot in November. And that would require them collecting probably about 120,000 signatures to be safe. And you're talking at a minimum $5 a signature, probably more at this point. So you're talking a ton of money just to get on the ballot in North Carolina. They've gotten around that. They're running as a party now. And Cornyn West has done the same thing. Both Kennedy and West have created parties. Kennedy is We the People and West is Justice for All. And that's an attempt to get around some of this ballot access restrictions. But, you know, Kennedy does have a lot of money behind him. He had that PAC that ran that $7 million ad during the Super Bowl. He has a number of very wealthy people behind him, that there are estimates that the amount of money in the super PACs for him is over $50 million. And he has shown that he's able to raise, just straightforward raising money from individual donors, that he's able to pull in tens of millions of dollars. So he's certainly in a position as an independent candidate that we haven't seen in the U.S. in 30 years. I mean, we've not seen anyone like Robert Kennedy in the U.S. since Ross Perot. And that's deliberate. That's not an accident, because after Ross Perot, the Democratic and Republican parties said never again. And the most overt thing they did was change the way the debates are set up to make sure that nobody else can be in the debates without the Republican, except for the Republican and Democrat. But the other way was tightening up the ballot access laws. And these ballot access laws, you go back to the history of it, just for people to understand, they've always existed, of course. But where they really pick up speed and really, really become an arm of the opposite, like this is an effective tool to keep ourselves in power, is during the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. And their primary purpose at that point were to keep socialists and communists off the ballot. So that's the genesis of this modern ballot access restriction that we have in this country, that keeps it so that it's very difficult. And by difficult, there's administrative hurdles, there's legal hurdles, because they will sue you or you will have to sue them. I mean, I ran a political campaign 2 years ago, if people are familiar with that, where we did everything we needed to do. We got all our signatures by a wide margin, and we went to the State Board of Elections to be certified to be on the ballot, and they lied. They said we had committed fraud and kept us off the ballot. And they had no evidence we had committed fraud, because we hadn't committed fraud, but they were just willing to lie. You had the spokesperson for the State Board of Election saying that our campaign, our petitioning, our ballot, our petitioning collection, our ballot access campaign, was a universe of fraud, that we had thousands and thousands of forged signatures. And it's completely untrue, you know? And so we had to sue in federal court. At the same time, the North Carolina Democratic Party, as well as the Democratic Party in Washington, D.C., Chuck Schumer's outfit, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, entered into it and sued us. And so we had to go to federal court. We won in federal court. And then we had to go to a federal appeals court. We won in federal appeals court. And at the same time, too, the Democratic State Party here in North Carolina had dropped their lawsuit against us in state court, because it was apparent they were going to lose, because they were going to lose, because, again, everything they were saying was a lie. But that's what they will do. We were fortunate. We were lucky. We had some great resources. We had a couple of great lawyers who were able to help us. But we were in the minority on that. We were the exception. Most independent or third-party campaigns don't have the resources that we did, don't have the luck that we did, don't have the people showing up like we did to defeat the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and North Carolina, the state of North Carolina, in federal court. You know, so that's, you know, so there's these legal hurdles. And so Kennedy and West will face that. But then the other thing, too, is just the money, just how much money it takes to do these types of ballot access campaigns. It keeps people off the ballot because, again, at a minimum, you're going to be spending about $5 per signature. We were able to do it in this state here last year or 2 years ago. I think it was about $2.50 a signature it cost us. And a lot of that was because we actually had a base of people who are already part of the Green Party or who identified as socialists or identified as, you know, progressive independent voters who wanted to see a multi-party system, who wanted to see more parties. So we had something to tap into. But if you're a truly independent candidate with no active base, you don't have those people resources, the human capital to pull from to begin with, you got to pay people to go out there and get the signatures and pay them a lot. And yeah, I mean, so it is. I mean, I know that's a long exposition there, but that shows like kind of what Kennedy is up against. And the reason why he's up against it is because the duopoly fears it. They fear people voting for Kennedy. They fear people voting for Stein. They fear people voting for West. They fear people voting for whoever the libertarian is going to be. Because it's not just threatening their power, right, their position. But I think what you see threatened most, Nima, is they're threatened about the dialogue. Again, this gets back to kind of our conversation on banning TikTok. Why did they spend millions of dollars trying to keep me off the ballot here in North Carolina? It wasn't because they thought I was going to win. Come on. You know, I mean, the reason was because they were afraid that if I was on the campaign, then issues like the war on drugs, issues like healthcare, issues like a living wage, things like that would be brought up. Things like that would be discussed in the campaign. And neither party wants that because those kinds of issues, the issues that are most important to people of North Carolina, are the things that are most detrimental to the big donors of the Democrats and Republicans. So when I ran 2 years ago, the biggest issues here in North Carolina across the state that I saw over and over again were of course, healthcare, housing, and the war on drugs, you know, specifically at this point, overdoses, but also to the whole prison and the whole incarceration tragedy that's occurred. But really, the overdoses, we have something like 13 overdoses a day here in North Carolina, and neither of the candidates, Republican or Democrat, would touch either of those issues, you know. And so, of course, they don't want people talking about those things because that's a threat to their donors, and so that's why they don't want Jill Stein talking about Medicare for all. That's why they don't want Cornel West talking about ending the war on drugs, or Robert F. Kennedy talking about reforming our healthcare system, particularly the control that our pharmaceuticals have over us. You know, so, you know, you see that what this gets to then is like, what does it all mean? And what it means is that they actually are, the duopoly is actually very much afraid of the people. And they're very much afraid of the power of the vote. And they understand that the way to keep themselves in power is to exclude others and to insulate themselves with money. And so if we understand that, then that's some way we can attack it and we can fight it asymmetrically. But certainly, you know, what these third-party independent candidates are up against is massive and it's deliberate. And again, it's along the lines of, you know, their rallying cry from 1992 with regards to Ross Perot, you know, never again.
Matt, when we look at Cornel West, Jill Stein, and even RFK Jr., we see that they have a lot in common and they can work with each other, it seems to me. Why not having an alternative to RND, Republican and Democrats, a unified party, a party that can embrace all these people together?
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people are asking for, Nima. I think that one of the problems for those on the progressive left, so those like myself, but many others too, I should say that with RFK Jr. is of course his embrace of Israel. He's more pro-Israel than Trump or Biden, if you can believe that. So that's immediately a non. You know, that's a non-qualifier. That you immediately, you know, RFK Jr. is not someone that I'm going to work with or support or help in any way just because of that issue. You know, how could you help somebody who's supporting genocide and lying so forcefully, in favor of it. But certainly you look at West and Stein, as well as the PSL candidates, like Claudia De La Cruz. And, their platforms overlap. And so what you get accused of, if you run as a third party independent in this country, is you get accused of spoiling the vote, which is possible if your platform overlaps enough with another party or another candidate. Then yes, of course, you will split the vote. And that's what you would see with Stein, West, and De La Cruz all on the ballot. I mean, there are degrees of difference, but they're essentially offering the same solutions. They embrace the same theories. They have the same type of viewpoint, and they have the same constituencies in many ways. So you are splitting the vote in that way. The idea that Jill Stein is somehow going to split the vote with Joe Biden, with Genocide Joe, right, with somebody who said, basically he would veto a Medicare for all if it ever came to his desk, somehow that, on those major, major issues of life and death, that somehow she's splitting the vote. I mean, there's much more in common between Trump and Biden than between Biden and Stein, much more in common. And I would say the same for the Libertarian, whoever they're going to have run against, the Libertarians have much less in common with Trump than Trump has with Biden. But this idea of having a unity ticket, I think, is something that many people on the left want to see. You see the amount of money and effort that Cornel West is going through right now to build a campaign, a party across the country to get ballot access that will, I don't believe there's any intention of Cornel West utilizing that party or that platform past November of 2024. So all this effort expires. What if you put that effort together? What if you combine those resources, that passion, that drive, that need, the understanding that exists among West and Stein supporters for something better, and that this is urgent, this is dire, people are dying because of this. Well, to have that type of unity. And, it gets into why did West... First, he was going to run with the People's Party, and that was a catastrophe. Then he was going to run with the Greens, and there is a lot of issues internally between his campaign and the Green Party. So West became independent, went on an independent path, and Stein stepped in to be the third time she's run for the Green Party in 4 years, which I think it tells you a lot about the Green Party. Like, I mean, I love Jill and I'm going to vote for her, and I encourage others to do so as well. But, why did Jill have to come out of the bullpen for this? How come there weren't other folks able to step up and do that? But the idea of having a unified party on the left, something that could demonstrate the frustration, the despondency, the anger of people in the United States, working class, lower income, as well as middle class people. Look, 60% of the United States, 60% of people in the United States are living paycheck to paycheck. Half of people who are making over $100,000 a year in the U.S. are living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, and that comes from a variety of surveys, including, I'm pretty sure, for the latter part of that's in the Federal Reserve's own information. So, I mean, this is not made up stuff. This is how people, and the people that we know, people we love who are living this way. One of the reasons I ran was because no one was talking about healthcare. Meanwhile, I've got a lot of friends who are having to check their bank accounts as to see whether or not they can call their doctor, right? And people who life wasn't supposed to be this way kind of thing, people who are having to make real serious choices in terms of taking care of their families based upon what's in their checking account for things that are essentially overhead costs, right? So housing, education, healthcare, all things that we have to assume and we're responsible for, that are crushing, not just the lower income and working class, but also the middle class. You'd love to see that with this in terms of a unity ticket. And, certainly there's still time for that. The problem is once you get to the point, say in September or so, when ballots start to get printed, you know, names are still going to be on the ballot. And if there hasn't been, you know, an announcement made by then and an ability to make sure that someone's followers know that they've dropped out and endorsed someone else, well, you know, you know, it's frustrating to see the need for a party that represents those people I was just describing, a party that takes seriously and believes in the existential nature of climate change, a party that's opposed to war, not just for moral principles, but because of the practical reality of war, you know, just based on the evidence that America can't win wars and that they're counterproductive to us, they're hurtful to us, they're so damaging to us, you know, let alone all the moral aspects of it. But the, you know, I mean, all these different things that could a third party on the left could represent that have significant support among the American people. I mean, one of the things you look at Jill's or Cornell's platforms, or say you look at Jill's platform, I don't know if there's anything on her platform that doesn't have majority or plurality support in the United States for. I knew that was the case in my platform. There was nothing on my platform to which you couldn't look and say, look, a majority of Americans support, you know, support ending the war on drugs, right? Majority of Americans support closing up American overseas military bases and bringing troops home, right? I mean, like, you know, or plurality, in this, you know, I mean, so, you know, it is. It's frustrating. You have an opportunity. The time is the urgency, but also I think the willingness of people to want to receive something like this. It's what people want. We see that we've got the numbers. 60% of Americans, more than 60% of Americans, would vote for a third party candidate. They're always, you know, the way they say that, Nima, is they always say it's a moderate candidate. But again, you look up and see what, you know, someone like Jill Stein, what her positions are, what's not moderate about that? The only way it's not moderate is it goes against corporate interests. And so that's considered left-leaning or left-wing or radical because it's against the interests of the corporate elite. You know, so, you know, whether we'll see something, I don't know. I don't know. Like I said, I hope so. I hope we'll see that. Hope we'll see West and Stein band together and then PSL with Claudia De La Cruz and Karina Garcia jump on board as well and have a unified ticket. I'd love to see that. But I also, too, even what I said about RFK Jr., I'm very happy he's running. Again, I'm not going to vote for the guy. I'm not going to support him, but very happy he's running. He needs to disrupt the system. And the same thing, too, even if no labels, which is if you think Biden and Trump are corporate candidates, this no labels party has been created by the corporations essentially to ensure there is a true corporate candidate, right? So no labels comes out of as an organization that's been around for about 10 years, and it's supposedly centrist or middle of the road. It's in that Bill Clinton 1990s tradition of the third way, which of course meant corporatism. And, you know, so no labels are saying they're going to run a candidate. And even if those candidates were, God help us, Liz Cheney, you know, whose name's been mentioned for it, you know, Ken Buck, this guy who just who's retiring next week from the Congress in Colorado, you know, he's his name's now being floated for it. Joe Lieberman, if people aren't aware, Joe Lieberman's still alive. His name's been floated for it. Joe Manchin very publicly turned it down. The idea that he turned that idea down a few weeks ago. But even if it was a Liz Cheney, Joe Lieberman ticket, God help me. God help me for saying that. But even if it was, I'm still in favor of it because anything that disrupts this duopoly we have, anything that causes stress to it, that is a disruption, I'm in favor of, because that's what we need to continue to do in order to get any type of political control in this country for the people. Something that we've had at times, very infrequent, but the best example is probably FDR and his New Deal legislation, right? Which is a sop to the socialists, the communists, those who are, you know, the labor unions, right? How strong they were in, say, the 30s. FDR's New Deal version, of course, is a watered down version of what they want, but it's the compromise that those on the left were able to get at that time. So there have been times when the people have been represented in the U.S. government infrequently, but it has happened. And it's because pressure is put onto the system and disruption occurs. And, you know, that's what we get with people like RFK Jr., running with Jill Stein, with Cornel West, with whoever the libertarian is going to be. So the more we can do that, the better. And of course, you know, I'm a person who believes that multi-party system, multi-party elections, to include then using ranked choice voting or, you know, things like that, eventually getting to proportional representation are the ways we should be heading in this country. But that is, anathema to the American system.
Matt, to wrap up this session, I want to talk about Bernie Sanders. Where does Bernie Sanders fit in this picture? Do you think that he's going to be supporting Democratic Party, Joe Biden, or whoever going to be the official and the final candidate of the Democratic Party, or he's going to support people like Jill Stein, Cornel West, these people who help him a lot? And we know he had a great chance of winning in those days, but how do you see him right now?
Sanders is going to support whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be. And I'm in the camp that believes that Biden's going to drop out and that the DNC will pick somebody to run, and that, you know, he'll drop out. Who knows? I mean, between both Biden and Trump now have enough delegates to be their party's nominees. And I think that was in my idea, the purpose of Biden running, beside his own interests, besides that's who his he is the figurehead for the section that runs the Democrats right now that come out of the Clinton camp. He's part of that. So of course they would want him to run and everything else, but as we've seen, his cognitive abilities, they're not there. They're not there. He should not be president. And I think that's recognized. And I think the issue with Gaza made it all the worse. And so I think this idea that Biden shepherds the party through the primaries, this makes it so that there's no one else who can have a claim at all to being the nominee except for Joe Biden. And I think that was very important for the DNC, because this way it allows them, if Biden drops out, to hand select. They don't want to leave it. They didn't want to have an open primary where they'd have to do the same things they did to Sanders in both 2016 and 2020, what was rigged. They just as soon not have to go through that and just hand pick somebody, right? So even less Democratic than they were before, right? Not Democratic at all. But the idea, though, is that now Biden takes on the chin about Gaza. And so that whoever the Democrats run, that was the old guy. That was the previous guy. And my thought is that they'll take someone like Gavin Newsom or J.D. Pritzker, J.B. Pritzker, governors who don't have any connection to foreign policy, and who say that they're focused on domestic issues, right? And kind of cut off this genocide as well as the catastrophe in Ukraine and leave that on the old team, right? I think that's where it's going. I think Sanders will endorse whoever it is, even if it's something as undemocratic, even as it's something that just reeks of 19th century cigar smoked back rooms. You know, I mean, like Sanders has shown who he is. I mean, they rigged their primaries against him twice and he stayed loyal to them. And the same thing too. You'll see that with AOC. You'll see that with other members of the squad. I don't even think Rashida Tlaib will break ranks if she hasn't done so already. I think the most you'll get out of Rashida Tlaib and other Democrats is what they did, which was worthy and very beneficial with their, particularly in Michigan, but we had it too. In North Carolina, we had almost 13% of people in the Democratic primary vote uncommitted. We call it no preference here. But, you know, in particular, that's really pretty good for a movement that was quickly put together without resources. You know, and Michigan got 15%. Minnesota got 20%, I believe. Other states around 10%. So to show that people came out to vote purposely against Joe Biden in the primary, to make that time, make that effort, that means a lot. But I think that's the extent of what of the limit of what you'll see in the pulling away. And a lot of it's because of self-preservation. You know, these other parties do not have the resources to allow for people to be elected. Money drives our political system. If you don't have the money, you are not going to win. You could, sure, there are times you can point to where someone who spent less money defeated someone who spent more money. There's all kinds of examples like that. But those are the exceptions, right? Those are the exceptions to the rule. If you enter into a congressional contest and you don't have any money behind you, you are not going to get anywhere. How are you going to let 750,000 people in your congressional district, how are you going to let them know you even exist? And in the case of someone like, say, Rashida Tlaib, she leaves a Democratic Party, the amount of money she's going to be able to raise outside a Democratic Party is a fraction of what she can raise within the Democratic Party. So they stay loyal to the party because they feel that that's the only way for them to keep their power. And so even those that we can describe as the best, we've seen that they have their limits in terms of where their principles will run up against the harsh realities of political survival. And, you know, I think you see someone like AOC, who has, I think, rightly been castigated these last couple of weeks for not willing to be able to say the word genocide and dancing all around it and everything. I think in AOC's case, her calculation is that she's not going to lose in her district. They can primary her with whoever she's going to win. Her consideration is future. So she's had plenty of people whisper in her ear, look, if you do this correctly, you can be the next senator from New York. Chuck Schumer is not going to be around forever. You can be the next senator from New York. But to do that, you can't say words like genocide. You know, I mean, so you have to realize this is one of the things I have to remind myself. You know, we get upset sometimes when politicians act like politicians. We have to understand, well, that's who they are. But if we understand that, again, if we understand these are people that our moral arguments are not going to have any power over, but if we understand what has the power over them, then we at least have a place we can begin to undermine them, a place at least we can come up with some type of plan, even if it has to be asymmetric because we don't have the same resources. You know, that is how we have to approach this. But again, I'll use my own example. People who want to give up on electoralism, who say it's not going to work. If that was the case, then why did the Democratic Party spend millions of dollars trying to keep me off the ballot? You know, right? I mean, they feel like it works. They are threatened by it. And we have to understand that and act on that.